Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Eat Better podcast with myself, Tommy Wood, and Chloe Archard from Paleo Britain. This is our sixth episode, and we have another guest this time. It's Owen Raybould, who we met back in October. And actually, back then, he was giving a talk about foraging because he's also a foraging expert. But today, he's going to talk to us about food, so nutrition and mood. He does some work with some mental health charities, teaching people about how to improve their nutrition and hopefully improve their mood through that. So Owen, why don't you start by just giving us a bit of background about yourself and how you got into that kind of work?
Hi Tommy, thanks for having me on. I've been following this podcast now for well since the start. And it's a great podcast. I'm really pleased to be on it.
That's great to have you.
So I was working in a local government back in 2009, 2010. And I had my own experience of clinical depression and a mood disorder, which led me to leave my job. And to cut a long story very short, I got into this nutrition thing and into the paleo movement and into doing research, and it naturally led me to come to an understanding of what had actually happened to me personally, and the kind of the skills that I'd acquired, should we say, working in the arena that I did. I ended up recently being able to put to good use in terms of putting together training material on this subject, and also doing the occasional public talk, which I've started to do in a variety of settings. I've done a talk at a literary festival in up here in Worcestershire, and I've basically been travelling around giving talks to the local support groups of the charities Mind and Depression Alliance.
Right.
And like you say, it's the other half of what I do is foraging, which is there is a tiny amount of overlap with this. I think we're going to be talking mainly about the food and mood side of my work.
Great. So you sent us a little bit of information about what you're doing with the Depression Alliance and Mind, and as usual, yeah, Chloe will get into question master mode. So yes. Chloe, let's get into it.
Okay, hi Owen, thank you for coming on to talk to us. My first question was really just many of us who read or write or talk a lot about nutrition and health would be completely on board with the idea that various health conditions can be improved by diet and lifestyle changes, but a lot of people out there don't share that view. And I think particularly with mental health, a lot of people would say, you know, diet's got nothing to do with it. Is this something you find a lot?
It's a viewpoint that I do come across. I think I'd say the majority of the people who end up actually attending my talks are probably going to already have some level of interest in the nutrition side, otherwise they presumably wouldn't be there in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
If you take, for example, the setup for a lot of the services that are out there for people with, clinical depression, nutrition features very kind of low on the radar, really. And at the moment, in any case, the main focus seems to be on things like CBT, which I'm sure is a perfectly valid exercise, and also things like talk therapy, and should we say, then there's obviously the traditional idea of things like medication as well.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of the publications, as I mentioned in my email to you, a lot of the publications that you'll find if you go into your average bookstore, such as Waterstones, do not pay much attention to nutrition. And I did manage to find one or two examples, but they were quite thin on the ground, really.
Mm.
and it struck me as being quite quite a strong indicator that nutrition is not currently viewed as a priority when it comes to mental health.
Mm.
And everything that I've looked into and all the research that I've done up until this point points towards nutrition as being absolutely fundamental.
Yeah.
And I think on a cultural basis, on a cultural level, in the way that we separate the mind from the body has led us, I think, down this route of ignoring nutrition when it comes to mental health.
Mm.
On the other side of the coin, charities like Mind and Depression Alliance are paying a lot of attention now to whatever options are out there, and they've paid a fair amount of attention to me, which is I suppose indicative of you know, changes coming through, shall we say?
Yeah.
And they are interested, and they've as a result of their kind interest, I've been able to start giving these talks, and I put together a course which I ran in the West Midlands for a branch of Mind, which was a very interesting and rewarding experience. It was a 9-week course, one session per week, with a group of their service users. So yeah, the interest is building, I would say, definitely.
And it's actually, you know, it's the kind of thing we've talked about before, but it isn't just mental health that nutrition's ignored. Actually, there's so many kind of chronic conditions that nutrition, you know, we don't consider that nutrition might play a role when actually it does play a really big role. So it isn't just mental health. And you believe we should take guidance from ancestral health principles when designing an optimal diet. Can you expand a bit more on these principles and why you feel these are so important when it comes to mental health?
Well, yeah, initially the reason that I got caught up in studying the ancestral health principles is because it worked so well for me personally. And I think that is a common characteristic in our movement, shall we say, is that most people have a background where they have encountered very, very good results when they personally apply these principles.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
As a result of doing it myself, I've kind of really become convinced that the ancestral health model is invaluable to anybody who might have any kind of mental health issue.
Mm.
And I think if you look at, for example, the connections that we're now drawing, and I'm sure Tommy would be able to elaborate the connections in terms of functional medicine, where we are looking as much at how the body as a whole functions as we are focusing on any individual area, then you know you realise that the brain is one organ in the body, and that is another reason why I think ancestral health and nutrition in particular should be a focus.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you think our modern day sugar intake is one of the worst problems? You sort of, when you're looking at people's diets, do you think that that's one of the worst problems? You mentioned a book in your email, The Mood Cure,
yeah,
where you talked about the sort of the increase in sugar intake. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of people who have become quite prominent recently who were raising issues about sugar consumption. In mainly in Western society. One of them is Julia Ross, who is the writer of a book called The Mood Cure. And she is was, I believe, a psychotherapist who, during the 90s and early 2000s, she developed a series of treatment programs that were based on nutrition and supplementation with certain amino acids. And the Mood Cure really came forward as a leading critique of the amount of refined sugar in our diet.
Mm.
It's really it's an interesting issue for a number of reasons, you know, and we often look at and criticise the amount of sugar that we're currently eating or being convinced to consume by things like marketing and commercial enterprises. But what appears to be the case is that refined sugar has an absolutely devastating effect on mood and on mood regulation for a large proportion of the population. And anybody, particularly anybody who is susceptible to something called hypoglycemia, will probably suffer from a diet that is high in refined sugar. The reasons for this are scientifically are kind of quite complex.
Mm.
And I'm kind of a layman who has come to this partly through experience and partly through my own research. But what I can see is that refined sugar, through destabilizing the levels of sugar in your blood, this has a knock-on effect in terms of the functioning of your brain, and also in terms of your endocrine system, your hormonal balance, and those two things together spell potential problems for a lot of areas of health, but only one of which is mood. So it's being implicated in most chronic disease now in Western society.
Yeah.
Obesity, heart disease, obviously type 2 diabetes is the obvious one. But it's definitely a factor when it comes to mood as well. And every piece of research that comes out now seems to be moving towards, should we say, pointing the finger.
And then, sugar.
Yeah, and then of course you've got people like Robert Lustig, who are pretty well known now and have a pretty clear and quite hard-hitting message about refined sugar. He doesn't focus on mood so much, but everything that he says applies to the work that I do as well.
So, Owen, can we go back to this concept of people who are at risk of hypoglycemia?
Yeah.
Because in my world, when you talk about hypoglycemia, it's a life-threatening condition, and it usually comes from something like diabetics who've taken too much insulin, or for the amount of carbohydrate they've eaten, or for people who have what we call like a complete adrenal failure, something like an Addisonian crisis, we call it, where you just can't make any cortisol and you can't regulate your blood sugar at all, and your blood sugar crashes. But that's hypoglycemia in this context isn't quite the same, is it? Can you like explain what they mean by that in terms of people who are at risk of hypoglycemia, and then that affecting potentially affecting mood?
Yeah, sure. Well, the term hypoglycemia, as I've encountered it, relates more to a chronic condition that is being looked at, particularly for some reason in Australia. If you go to the Hypoglycemic Association of Australia, you'll see that they are promoting this concept as being something that the whole population should pay attention to. And it is very closely connected, as far as they're concerned, to the amount of refined sugar in the diet. And what they're proposing is that chronic consumption of refined sugar will give rise to a type of hypoglycemia that, amongst other things, has a very significant effect on your mood. And what I've read is that the hypoglycemic state occurs when you release your body panics in response to a high dose of refined sugar, much higher than the body is designed to take. And then following on from that, the insulin response causes your blood sugar to ironically be kind of completely depleted. So the irony is that you eat a very hot, very sugary food, and the end result within a set period of time, such as an hour or 2 hours, is that there's very little sugar left in your blood, and this is when the brain starts to have problems, really. And this is what leads us on to something called adrenal fatigue, which is something that Julia Ross again. She has gone into quite a lot of detail about adrenal fatigue, and I can probably kind of explain the link between hypoglycemia and that if you want me to.
Yeah, I mean that would be great. Just the one thing that for I think in term when you're talking about blood sugar control, I think it's important that people realize that your body, unless you're a type 2 diabetic, your body is quite good usually at regulating blood sugar levels or blood glucose levels. So usually when people, you know, when their blood glucose is dropping too low, they're usually very good at bringing it back up. And I think a lot of the symptoms that people see when their blood sugar drops, and this is very usual, you know, somebody gets hungry and then they get angry and cranky and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It's not actually a function of just of the low blood sugar, because what it's actually a function of is the body releases a huge amount of adrenaline and cortisol together, because both adrenaline and cortisol can increase the production of glucose from stores like glycogen, and it's actually the effect—it's the effect that adrenaline and cortisol have on the brain. Because you know that when you get stressed, you get cranky, and they sort of make you—they turn you into that kind of very aggressive, stressed kind of. So it's—I think it's as you try and increase blood glucose, your body releases adrenaline and cortisol, and then that has a lot of the mood effects. But then obviously once you get down the road, once you stop being able to mount that kind of response, then maybe you're heading into, you know, some real end level adrenal fatigue, and that's when you just can't mount any kind of response to stress, and then potentially your blood sugar drops. But does that kind of tie in potentially to what you've seen?
You're indicating to me that the adrenaline and the cortisol issues come into play a lot sooner, should we say, than I previously understood it to be the case. But nonetheless, it's definitely that definitely makes a lot of sense what you're saying with regards to those hormones. Yeah.
Could you tell us about the effects of say potentially refined sugar and on cortisol signaling and things like the adrenal glands, and I'd also be interested in terms of are we just talking processed sugar like
sucrose? I was just literally going to ask the same question.
because you know, if I eat a whole load of pasta, that's not, I mean, there's no sugar in there, but it's obviously very rapidly broken down to glucose. So do they include that in their definition?
Well, the main issue seems to be high sugar foods, where you have like processed foods like soda, fizzy drinks, sweets, cakes, anything that has and what is for the body an inordinately high level of sugar. And I suppose it could include things like pasta, but you would probably have to eat a very large amount before that would happen.
Okay.
The issue seems to be once adrenal fatigue starts to occur, which of course is where the body is releasing adrenaline is releasing adrenaline every day. So you know, if it was to happen once a month, then it wouldn't be so much of an issue. But it's more the fact that it gives rise to a chronic condition where the body is having adrenaline in its system every single day, and we, you know, from an evolutionary point of view, adrenaline is meant to be used for fight or flight, as most people would understand. From what I've read, adrenaline itself is quite a damaging hormone, and can have a knock-on effect in terms of the functioning of things like the endocrine system, and potentially also the brain. So the fatigue, if you like, comes from, theoretically anyway, comes from the damage that is done by having this very potent hormone in your body every day, or maybe even two or three times a day, as a result of your eating habits.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically through the consumption of foods that are unnaturally high in sugar, in refined sugar. You mentioned other sources of sugar. I would say that the reason that eating things like fruit, for example, doesn't seem to give you the same result is because fruit is comparatively lower in terms of the amount of sugar that is in it to start with, but also because of the characteristics of the constituent parts of fruit, it creates a kind of a slow release effect. And there are also other nutrients in that food to kind of help to balance everything out. And that is my understanding anyway of why it would appear that eating fresh fruit wouldn't give you the same kind of adrenal response that eating very processed high sugary foods would.
There's a lot written in the paleo community about the link between gut health and disease. Do you think this connection is important for mental health as well?
Moving away from sugar, that the other area of research that I talk to people about is gut health and autoimmunity, and it is as you probably see, it's a big theme at the moment in the ancestral health community is gut permeability and autoimmunity, and it turns out that there appears to be a lot of connections between gut health and mental health. Definitely, yeah.
Do you have any particular examples?
I've been showing people some of the research into gut health. There is a woman called, you may have heard of her, called Natasha Campbell McBride, who has written a book called The GAPS Diet.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a neurologist who has drawn a connection between gut health and a number of different areas of brain development, including things like autism. And it would appear that there's a lot of indication that where you have gut permeability, you have an effect on the development of brainy children, but also the day-to-day functioning of the brain in adults as well. And this is where mood is potentially one of the factors.
Some people are finding success on really strict protocols like the paleo autoimmune protocol and also the what's called the Walls protocol, but Terry Walls's diet for people suffering from multiple sclerosis. Why do you think those protocols are successful?
Do you mean for mood as well, or
for mood as well? Yeah, for mood as well.
Yeah, it does seem that they are, and I think it does tie into this this autoimmunity thing, where if you have a very robust digestive system, then there is far less chance of you developing any kind of mood disorder or any kind of depression. Now, if you look at the three categories of food, as I present it to people anyway, the three categories of food really are the Paleolithic group of food, which is your fruits, vegetables, animal foods, nuts and seeds, maybe eggs. Then you have the agricultural era foods, where we know that during the agricultural era, these foods became far more commonly consumed, which is the grains, legumes, and dairy products. And then the third category is the industrial processed foods. But with regards to autoimmunity, it appears that the safe route, if you like, in terms of gut health, is to stick to exclusively the Paleolithic foods, even if that is for a controlled period of time, just to see how you get on, you know. Although there's a lot of debate and a lot of, research into the agricultural foods and who should be consuming them, and maybe some people can and some people can't, but if you want to be assured of a healthy gut, then at the moment anyway, the indicators are that the autoimmune type diets, where the focus is exclusively on the Paleolithic food groups, that is a very safe option and a very reliable, route to go down. Sorry, going back to the, you asked me for an example of the connection between autoimmunity and mood, and I forgot to mention the obvious one, which is the paper that really it kind of opened my eyes to this area, which was a paper that I read on molecular psychiatry. And this drew a connection between our evolutionary past and the reason why people get maybe suffering from more depression in the modern era. And it's to do with the fact that our immune system is designed to deal with basically injury and infection. And it was designed by evolution, because during our Paleolithic past, if you like, it was mainly injury and infection that it had to fight. And as a result of it developing during this period, what we had was two behaviours that became, if you like, helpful to any individual who suffered from an infection or an injury. And those two behaviours are, the first one is called hypervigilance, which is otherwise known as anxiety. And the hypervigilance was useful in order to prevent any further incidents of the injury or the infection taking place. So you would become, first of all, you would become anxious when your immune system was, if you like, kick-started. And the second behavior that is classic when the immune system is running is withdrawal. Which is where somebody would effectively hide away. Now, if you look at any modern person who is appears to be suffering from clinical depression, what you'll find is that they are displaying both of those behaviours at the same time. And it's almost like two sides of the coin, if you like. They will be simultaneously hiding away, but they will also be anxious and hypervigilant.
Mm-hmm.
And according to this paper, what that would show you is that their immune system is being worked quite hard, is being overworked, if you like. So the question is, in the modern setting, what is the cause of this tax on their immune system? And this is where we come into, the pro-inflammatory foods that we can be eating, there are obviously other factors that could come into play, but it would appear that a very significant one is diet.
Mm-hmm.
That is probably why an autoimmune diet is a really, really good idea for somebody who is suffering from any kind of low mood.
So do you think it's a function of just reducing systemic inflammation? Because, almost every chronic disease we've studied is associated with an increase in inflammation, and then also any kind of increase in systemic inflammation then predicts mood problems later on. So is that the connection that you think is going on?
Yeah, and there are other papers of similar nature to this one that I mentioned that are clearly displaying the connection between what they call inflammatory markers. You'll be able to tell me if this is right, but I believe they're called cytokines.
Cytokines.
The if you find inflammatory markers in somebody's blood, then that is statistically a predictor of a later onset of depression.
And you sent me this paper, which is absolutely fascinating, and I picked out a couple of things which I thought people might find interesting. And sort of part of the theory is that we've essentially selected for genes that when under acute stress, we get a bigger inflammatory response to boost our innate immunity, which is basically the immune system that acts first and just sort of tries to get its foot in the door in terms of dealing with an infection particularly. And so these genes, that we've selected for increase that inflammatory response to get a bigger initial immune reaction. But then if you chronically if you chronically stimulate the immune system, then you end up with those depressive symptoms in the longer term. And two that I picked out were, so two of these genes, is there something going on over there? I can hear a lot of noise.
Yeah, I can hear it as well. I'm not sure where it's coming from.
Chloe, are you all right?
Yeah, I can't hear any noise. I don't know quite what's happening.
Oh, okay. Never mind.
What can you hear?
Nobody touch their microphone if that's what's going on.
What kind of noise is it?
It just sounds like somebody's touching their microphone.
Oh, no, I don't think so.
Okay.
Is that any better?
Yeah, that's better.
Okay.
Okay. So I picked out a couple of interesting gene mutations that might be selected for because they increase the initial immune response and might prevent disease, but then could later on, if chronically stimulated, and chronic inflammation or chronic stress could then lead to depressive symptoms. And one was MTFHR677T, so that's a mutation in the methyl tetrahydrofolate reductase gene, which people talk a lot about now in terms of methylation and, you know, B12 and folate and all that kind of stuff, and that can lead to increased inflammation if you have a bad balance there. And the other one is the APOE4 gene, which people talk about because if you have APOE4, it increases risk of things like Alzheimer's, and that's probably because of increased inflammation. But if you look at those carriers, when they're exposed to something like a viral illness or a diarrheal illness, they'll actually, their symptoms will resolve much faster. So these are things that in the long term, when we're chronically stressed, will increase the risk of certain diseases, but they were selected for because they actually might improve the immune response initially.
Sorry, Chloe. So I was just saying, it's so fascinating because I've not heard any of that before. It's so interesting.
Yeah, I'd love to learn more about those two particular genes. That sounds really interesting. It does also demonstrate a general principle as well, which is that if the immune system works in that way, if it's only for a temporary period of time. So, in the ancestral conditions, the immune system would only have been called upon until the infection or the injury was sorted out. Whereas the difference is that in the modern setting, if you're chronically stimulating the immune system, you're stimulating a very powerful mechanism every day. And that is presumably what is, in this kind of case, would give rise to the danger of something like depression or low mood, or maybe even something more serious, you know, like a more serious mental illness, such as schizophrenia. And you mentioned Alzheimer's as well, which is... yeah, I suppose slightly different, but certainly in that same arena.
And is associated with that kind of chronic inflammatory picture.
One of the things that you did mention as well was actually sort of talking about this, the difference between the treatment for acute versus chronic disease. And this kind of ties in with that, just because what you're saying is that sometimes... possibly these things are coming because of this like chronic overstimulation of the immune system, which can be quite a different thing to when someone's got acute disease.
I do speculate, and for my part it is speculation, but I indicate to my audience when I speak to people is the idea that mood disorders should probably fall under the umbrella of chronic metabolic type diseases rather than the acute disease of something like an injury or an infection. And I think it can be very helpful if people can understand something like depression from that viewpoint, is that it isn't probably most likely to be metabolic in nature. And connected to chronic health issues rather than anything else. And if you then track the trends in society in terms of obesity, heart disease, diabetes, etc., you'll notice that depression has grown in tandem with those conditions, which is another kind of very strong indicator that they should be that they're probably should we say, closely connected. And when I'm speaking about this this issue to people, I do raise medication at that point. And I don't kind of, you know, attack medication. I don't necessarily think, even in the case of depression, I'm not qualified to, you know, to go into a lot of detail about medications and how they work. But as a general observation, it would appear that medications are fantastic in the arena of acute medicine, but don't appear to be quite so effective in the arena of chronic medicine. Uh-huh. And that applies not just to my kind of area of inquiry, but it seems to be a much wider issue that that is out there at the moment.
One of the things that Tommy and I have discussed a bit on here about is all the argument that goes on about diet and people arguing different viewpoints about what people should eat and what is actually going to help people. You've mentioned this a little bit where you've talked about what's kind of the safe, if you want to be really safe, what kind of food groups you would include. What do you advise people as a starting point then in your courses that you kind of feel is, you know, do you always say people should go on something like a strict paleo diet? Or what kind of advice are you giving to people on where to start?
Well, I kind of try to get that advice in without necessarily couching it in terms of, paleo or
mm-hmm.
anything like that. And what I tend to try to get people to just to consider a very simple approach, which basically gets protein from the best quality sources they can find.
Mm-hmm.
Plenty of fresh vegetables and leafy greens, which are obviously beneficial for a wide range of reasons, but one of which is gut health. And then when it comes to carbohydrates, to go for the safer, as Paul Jaminet would say, the safer starches.
Mm-hmm.
So roots and maybe fruits. So you've kind of got the three areas there: the quality protein, the carbohydrates from safe sources, and plenty of fresh vegetables and salads and things like that. Mm-hmm. And then when it comes to snacking, I try to get people to focus as far as possible on fruit. And that is really the basis of the advice that I give people. Try and keep it as simple as I can, but also as safe as I can, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, and I think it is really important to keep it simple. And what lifestyle tips do you give to people to help alongside dietary changes?
Well, this became a bit of a theme, if you like, during the course that I ran. We would get into discussions at the end about people's lives, if you like, and it just went to prove that a lot of what is said about in the ancestral health community is very true and very interesting. Is that modern life is probably the structure, if you like, of modern life does cause a lot of the stresses and the strains that can show themselves up in things like depression, for example. I've started to raise issues around sleep and movement, definitely. I've got an infographic that I show people, which is basically eat, sleep, and move as being the three legs of the health stool, if you like. And then within that, there are a few other considerations, such as your the connections that you have, the social connections that you have, things like a sense of purpose, and also outdoor activities of sunlight and being outdoors on a regular basis. But I've also done a couple of blog posts on winter, and particularly winter in northern latitude like the one that we have. And the fact that as a society and as a culture now, we seem to basically try to maintain the same activity patterns in the winter that we do in the summer. And that this is probably not ideal and certainly not conducive to optimal mental health. So I've been raising the concept of sleeping more in winter, actually doing less in winter, doing less full stop, you know, during the winter period, and maybe putting yourself under less pressure to be as active and to be as, productive, if you like, because all of the prompts and all of the clues that we get from our environment are that we should slow down, and this has been quite an interesting and quite a useful discussion as well, and it goes away from the diet, but certainly I'm glad that I started to do that.
I think. Because I've done a bit of digging into this kind of stuff purely because of conversations with you, Owen, which have been fascinating so far. You've been a bit of a, you know, sort of a sounding board where I can just like say random stuff, and you sort of you know, you're happy to at least entertain my thought processes when I'm going down some kind of strange pathway, but. So one thing that I think has really stood out to me is the fact that there's a real interaction between chronic stress and things like, say, sugar or kind of junk food in the diet. And I think it would be very difficult maybe to unpick the two. And there's some fascinating research that I mentioned before we started recording, is that in... America, that in some places they have these huge primate labs with rhesus monkeys, and they have these communities of rhesus monkeys that they kind of maintain and do various research on. And regardless of how you feel about that, what it's probably as close as we can get to seeing things and how they would you know, mimic what happens in humans without actually experimenting on humans. And one thing they notice is that if you have, say, lots of females together, they'll create a social hierarchy, and you'll end up with subordinate females. And these females, the subordinate ones, are chronically stressed. So it's kind of our equivalent of not sleeping enough, having a stressful job, and, you know, eating bad food or something like that. So they have that similar kind of cortisol response. And then what they do is they can look at how different females, either the subordinate or the non-subordinate or the dominant females, and how they respond, and then how they eat in response to things like that. And so they can give them either like a high fat and sugar diet, which Purina, the company that makes them, actually calls the typical American diet made by Purina, which is high fat and high sugar. And then they have a low calorie diet, which is less fat, no sugar, but lots of fiber. And that's actually, so monkeys do have some hindgut fermentation, so most of that fiber will actually be turned into fat by the gut bacteria, so it's not technically a low fat diet, but anyway. And what they notice is that if you give these monkeys like a synthetic cortisol, which should push down your cortisol in response and like a normal feedback mechanism, in the subordinate females that doesn't happen. So in these chronically stressed females, cortisol doesn't respond like it's supposed to, and we obviously see that in humans as well. But then interestingly, once you stress them again and you sort of socially exclude them, particularly the subordinate females will then eat a lot more of a high fat and high sugar diet, and then in response to that again they'll get an even bigger increase in cortisol. So if you're talking about the effects on the adrenal glands and then potentially later mood symptoms, there's a huge interaction between chronic stress and the diet, and maybe sort of individually they don't have that much of an effect, and it's really the two together. And you see things like in people with chronic stress, they get a down regulation of dopamine receptors in the brain, and then they're basically constantly craving reward because they don't get any, because the body isn't signaling any dopamine, which is one of the main reward neurotransmitters. And then those people do sort of crave sugary food and you know, that high fat sugar food that you know, we know causes overeating. And again, if you look at like kids who eat lots of sweet food, then they seem to have higher levels of cortisol. So I think the fact that you're bringing in the lifestyle stuff is really important, because there's a huge interaction factor there.
As you were relating that, which is interesting, the thing that came to my mind was a conversation I had with people, somebody in the office of one of the charities that I've been working with at their head office. And we had this joking conversation, actually, where we kind of observed that I kind of went through all of this stuff that I've been researching, and then we looked around the room and we noticed that there were two or three sections of the room devoted to piles of sugary food.
Yeah.
That they'd obviously been kind of like, snacking on throughout the day, and it was commented on as a joke. But then during one of the talks that I gave, I think I was in Buckinghamshire at the time, somebody said, what would you say to somebody who's at work who wants to try to improve their health and they don't have very much time to cook and this, that, and the other. And the first thing I said to them was, do you have what I refer to as workplace sugar sharing on a daily basis? and she laughed and she said, yeah, we absolutely do.
Yeah.
And it's the one thing that is really prevalent, especially in offices all around the country and maybe around the world, I don't know, is this either there's a vending machine or there is a chocolate bar section that people go to when they're stressed. So it's very telling. Yeah, it really is.
And you see a lot of that in like healthcare type settings. You know, you'll see it on the ward in hospitals, or you know, in sort of the workplace of these charities that are working with people with mental health, and it's a lot of that. You know, these are fairly stressful jobs where people are looking after other people, and you know, especially if you're a government employee or a charity employee, I think you worked pretty hard. So then that kind of stuff becomes more and more prevalent as you kind of feel that the need for that kind of sugar is stress and sleep deprivation and everything sort of takes over.
Yeah, it's very illuminating, actually. If you kind of compare that with the study that you mentioned on the rhesus monkeys and the kind of amazing similarities,
yeah,
say between the two situations. You could probably do a podcast on just that subject.
No, absolutely. I've done a couple of blog posts previously about sort of appetite and how that kind of happens. And there's a real, I think there's a real risk then when you're talking about, you're talking about people who work in some kind of support industry for others, and that, you know, the stress involved with that, you know, people who work in the healthcare system, like, so doctors or nurses or whatever, they have some of the worst diets because A, they don't have time to eat, and then B, because of the sort of combination of stress and sleep deprivation and all that kind of stuff. So people who are helping others often in that context end up eating worse.
Yeah, and that's something I've personally experienced. As I said, I worked in local government, and for a period of that time, I was in departments that were providing certain social care services.
Yeah.
Sometimes working alongside medical services as well, and yeah, it was endemic. the sugar, it was almost like a daily ritual, you know.
Yeah. Oh, I think Chloe's got got a bit of a cough and potentially a child emergency. So,
all right, okay.
Did you have anything else that you wanted to cover? One question that I had was, you sent me your course outline, and I know you're trying to raise some funding now so that you can continue to provide this service to Mind and the Depression Alliance.
Yes.
So my first question is, do you mind if I add the outline to the show notes so that people can kind of see what you're covering in your course, so they know what you'd be planning to teach. Is that okay?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it's just a syllabus, if you like, that I send to anyone who's interested. So yeah, that'd be fine.
Great. And then could you tell us a bit about that kind of the money you're trying to raise, and so that you can continue this kind of work, and how people can read up about it or contribute to it if they think that, you know, that's the kind of thing they want to do.
Yeah, sure. It started when I was running that course at Mind here in the West Midlands. I got into a discussion with various service managers, and it became apparent that as with many services now, they're becoming increasingly strapped for cash, and are struggling to procure even the baseline services that they would like to.
Yeah.
And it got me thinking about ways that I might be able to kind of meet them halfway in terms of what I do. And then the subject of crowdfunding came up. So I decided to look into this in a bit more detail, and I've set up a crowdfunding page, actually on the site of a crowdfunder, which is called Nutrition for Better Mental Health. The title doesn't exactly trip off the tongue, but it at least tells you what it's for. I'm basically interested to find out how far I can go with it. It's going to be, I'm in the very early stages, and it's a learning curve for me in terms of whether I can make this work. But what I've done is I've set up a system of a target to provide 40 of these support sessions around the country, which normally last between 2 or 3 hours.
Yeah.
And I'm therefore attempting to raise just over £5,000 in order to be able to provide them without having to, if you like, invoice these charities for the service. And I've worked it out so that I'm being paid a very modest amount of money for my time, and less than I actually get paid directly by the charities themselves. But I wanted to just see if I could make this work. So it's at the moment, it's an experiment.
Yeah.
to see where it goes. And what's probably, in all honesty, what's likely to happen is that I will run the campaign a couple of times before I'm, should we say, au fait with how to even do it.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's something that I'm kind of very passionate about in terms of making this service available to the public in whatever way I can, really.
Absolutely. That's great. When you first told me about this crowdfunding thing, I know that this, that you're crowdfunding just so that you can provide your services as, you know, part, so, you know, you can eat as well as teach people how to eat well,
yes,
which is important. But, you know, I calculated that basically including all your travel time and stuff, you're basically asking people to pay you minimum wage. So, you know, I don't think that that's too much to ask, really, in this. And I really believe this is a fantastic service that you're providing people. So I really hope people support you in that. We're kind of reaching the pain threshold in terms of podcast length. So why don't you briefly tell us about where people can find you on the net and otherwise, and about anything else that, you know, and information about the work you're doing.
Yeah, sure. Well, if you go to the Depression Alliance website, you'll find that I'm a blogger on there. I've got two articles at the moment on there that you can read. One about winter and one about nutrition.
Yeah.
And if you just search for Owen on there, you should get me. I don't actually have my own website yet, which is a bit shameful. But I'm using social media quite a lot. I have a Facebook group, which is Ancestral Health and Nutrition. It's called Ancestral Health and Nutrition. And then I'm also on Twitter on Owen_333. So that's at the moment where I am on the net, and I am putting together. I'm putting together a foraging website, which will be available soon, hopefully.
We'll have to get you back on soon to chat about foraging, definitely.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, yeah. The foraging actually is something that is going to be in the next few weeks. I'm suddenly going to be everywhere with the foraging. So it, on account of the fact that that's when everything starts to appear, you know, in terms of foliage and edibles. So I tend to do that in the milder months, more than the coaching, if anything. But,
Great.
Brilliant.
Yeah, you're okay, Chloe. You survived.
Yeah, just about.
Okay.
Thank you so much for coming on, Owen.
Oh, thank you. And can I just say very quickly before we finish, I just want to thank you guys, in particular Tommy, for the support that he's and the interest that he's shown in what I'm doing. It's been really encouraging to be able to interact with you in the ways that we have, and has given me some inspiration, you know, to carry on. So thanks for your help. And it's really good for people's mental health if we can form these kind of communities and these kind of mutual benefit arrangements. And one of the things that I noticed when I came into the ancestral health and the paleo community was the way that people support each other and encourage each other, which I was really impressed by. And that is, I think, very, you know, really valuable. So I just want to say thanks there.
I think we'll call it a day there. Thank you again, Owen. It's been great. And, you know, if people have more questions about food and mental health, then maybe they can contact me. I'm at drragnar.com, drragnar.com, Chloe at paleo-britain.co.uk, or they'll come and find you at Ancestral Health and Nutrition on Facebook and on Twitter. And then, you know, if they have any questions, they can, you guys can contact us and we can always bring Owen back on and get into it again. But for the meantime, thanks very much and we'll speak to you soon. Bye.
Thanks. Bye, everyone.
Thanks. Bye. Bye.